From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Roseanne Cash knew there would be some expectation that she would take to the stage. She was, after all, the daughter of Johnny Cash. And while she always loved art, she felt ambivalent about going public with it and committing to it. And then she says she had a dream that shook her to the core. From there on out, Cash committed herself to art, and not just to songwriting, though the experience did change the way she approached her music. But she also began to paint and to write prose. It was one of those moments where she had to decide, was she in or out? Roseanne Cash is coming to Utah next week. Today in the program, she's joining us to talk about art and music and other things, too. Her interests are pretty broad, and they include theoretical physics. Roseanne Cash today, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Roseanne Cash had been exposed to the world of art and music all her life, really. When she graduated from high school at 18, she went on the road with her father, Johnny Cash, and she wondered if this would become her life. Roseanne Cash has written a book that includes her feelings of ambivalence about living a life like this in the public. She's always had a deep affection for art, but how to express it and where? And the question was whether she was really willing to commit to it. Today in the program, Roseanne Cash is joining us. There's a lot to talk about. Art, obviously. She writes, she paints. Lately, she's been thinking a lot about theoretical physics, so we'll talk about it. She's coming to Utah, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. We invite you to join us if you like with comments or questions. 801-585-WEST is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Roseanne Cash has recorded 14 albums, including two gold records. Her 2009 studio recording, The List, featured songs drawn from a list of essential music that her father suggested she learn. It also won Americana Album of the Year when it was released. Her most recent album is a retrospective of her work. It's called The Essential Roseanne Cash. She's also written the book I mentioned, a memoir called Composed. And she's going to be in Utah next week in Layton at the Davis Arts Council. We'll give you the details, as I said. Roseanne Cash is joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Roseanne Cash, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thank you.
Well, I guess the place to start is with theoretical physics. I was really interested in and we can talk about what it is that you find so intriguing about it, but it made me wonder if you felt like you were always destined to be, you know, a songwriter or an artist, or did you think that if things had turned out differently in some ways, you know, that maybe you would have been a scientist?
Wow, that's a intriguing idea. I do love science. I mean, I feel about theoretical physics and quantum physics that some way, and some people feel about religion. I the mystery of it and the beauty and the poetic language of it. I mean, this, you know, dark matter and the event horizon. Yeah. All of these things are really intriguing and kind of poetically inspiring. I don't pretend to understand it. I have physicists who are friends who deign to talk down to me and try to explain it in eighth grade terms, but yeah, the idea of another parallel universe where I was a scientist, that's very intriguing.
So the thing that interests you about that is that it seems like it's that it kind of gives you a better understanding of how the world works. Like some people, that's what religion does. Conventional religion, religion didn't really take for you. So in some ways, this is your way of kind of understanding how it all fits together?
Or not understanding and being really excited by not understanding.
Huh.
The mystery of it, excuse me, the mystery of it is what is so intriguing to me. And the fact that it's still unfolding, you know, that theoretical physicists work in the unknown every day. And, you know, the fact that the Higgs boson, this is just 2012, they're just finding this little particle, this new kind of particle, and what's in store for us.
Mm.
It's exciting, and also I don't. For some reason, it gives me a feeling of safety and comfort. Like this is not all up to me. There's something bigger at work.
So you're okay with the idea that you don't know?
I'm
like
totally
the mystery.
Okay with it.
Yeah,
I love it. I like what Rilke said, that you have to love the questions.
There's this story I've heard you tell about this man, Mark Everett. And he talks about his father, Hugh Everett, who was the man who really defined this idea of the multiverse, you know, there being these right. parallel universes. And his father dies of a heart attack. And then his daughter, she commits suicide.
So she his could be, Mark's sister.
Mark's sister. So she could right. be with him in this parallel universe.
Oh, it's the saddest concept I've ever heard. Yeah. And there's a BBC documentary about Mark and about discovering who his father was by discovering the theories, the multiverse theories. And he went to Princeton where his father worked and, you know, talked to his colleagues and read the papers. And it's such a moving story. And yeah, the daughter who wanted to join the father in another universe. I mean, I think we've all felt like that.
Yeah. Well, there's this question, I think it comes up in the documentary or something, that where this woman in an audience asks, is that what heaven is?
Yes. It's not in the documentary. That was a live panel. I went to hear Mark and these physicists from Princeton and elsewhere. And the last question of the night was a woman said, if you die, do you go to a parallel universe? Is that what heaven is? Mm. And none of the physicists wanted to touch that question, I should say.
Right.
There was a lot of hemming and hawing, like, well, and finally one guy says, it's possible. But if you were there, you would think that was the real you. And this is the specter.
Do you wonder? Is that what heaven is in some way? How would you answer the question?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I wouldn't presume to know something or say I know this is so. But I like the idea. It just moves energy to a nearby plane that maybe we can perceive, maybe we can't, but it's so close.
Your daughter came to you not so long ago, and she asked you this question, which really kind of got to you. She was getting at this question of, you know, she wanted to know if there's a way to have a successful career as a musician, but not have the public life part.
If not you can be have, famous.
Not be famous, yeah.
She said, could I be successful as a musician and not be famous? I said, if you find out, let me know.
Well, you say it was the same question you kind of worked through when you were younger.
Yeah, I was not drawn to a public life. But, you know, if you want to be successful and you want to be a musician, it's part and parcel. It's like an occupational hazard. Mm. And I've grown comfortable with it. I mean, I've matured into it. It was more difficult when I was in my 20s and 30s. And, you know, I have a very rich private life that I keep private.
Yeah.
And I think that's one way that I did come to terms with it.
In your book, you mentioned that someone once told you that you should perform to the 6% of the audience who are poets.
Yeah.
My friend
John Stewart told me that.
Yeah. So how do you think about the people who are? I mean, I think that, to me, sort of got to the question of who are you doing this for? You know, I mean, what's the relationship like with an audience, with the public?
Wow, that is a great question that opens up. I mean, we could talk for a couple hours about who are you doing this for.
Yeah.
Ultimately, I'm doing it because that's my nature and that's my – I don't want to say mission because that sounds too grand, but that's my work in this life. I'm doing what I'm meant to do, what my DNA requires me to do, what I'm good at. I'm doing what I'm good at. But I do believe that a song is not complete until it has a listener and that performance is a big part of this. And, you know, there's a different chemistry every night with a new audience and they came for something. And I don't presume I can give them what they came for, but I can try to create a space where we can both get what we came for. Mm. And it's such a beautiful thing that it's so temporal. At the end of those 2 hours, it's over. That's like a monk sand painting that's been wiped clean. It's done. And there's something really beautiful about that to me. And they're all different. You know, there's a different chemistry every night.
Yeah.
ultimately, I have a perfect listener in my mind when I'm writing and when I'm performing. And if the audience is, you know, if they're on their Blackberries in the front row or they're drunk or, you know, they're kind of drifting, I find my perfect listener somewhere.
But the perfect listener isn't you. I mean, you're not. This is not about just pleasing yourself.
No, that's – it can't be just about pleasing myself. It's, you know, it's just too navel-gazing.
Yeah.
It's about connecting.
There's this – you write in the book about reading this interview with Linda Ronstadt. And in it, she said that you had to to be an artist, you really had to refine your skills to, I think this is how you put it in the book, refine your skills to support your instincts.
Yes.
And it really made this deep impression on you. And you write about how it wasn't long after that that you had this incredibly strange, I guess, but incredibly impactful dream. I wanted you to talk about that dream.
Yeah, that statement she made did make a powerful impact on me, and I wrote it down, and I think I carried it in my wallet for a while. And then I had this dream that I met this man at a party named Art. And
very subtle.
Yeah, subtle, right? I need to be hit over the head. And he was talking to Linda at the party, you know, and I had recently heard her make this statement. And I tried to engage them in conversation, and he turned to me and he said, "We don't respect dilettantes." And I was devastated and humiliated in the dream. And I woke up and I was shaken to the core and realized that I'd been dabbling in what I did. I had only really scratched the surface. And I at that point, I had had multiple number one records and I was really successful. And it just felt like a sham to me. So I made a commitment to go deeper, learn more, find out, you know, take risks, let it be scary. And I started painting then. Mm. And not that I'm a good painter at all, but it was a tool to kind of wedge open a new door for me.
It's interesting that you've talked about how when you started painting that you gave up language for a while.
Yeah. Well, I set myself a test to see how it felt to make art without language. And I was also just sick of the sound of my own voice. You know, I'd been a songwriter for a long time by then. And I found the process of painting, it was exactly the same as songwriting. It was, you know, at some point this critical voice that wanted me to stop came in. You know, I'll never be as good as Bob Dylan. I'll never be as good as Jackson Pollock. So what's the point? And, you know, how to get past that voice and edit later and complete the project. It was really instructive. And then when I came back to writing, it was so fresh and wonderful, and words made sense to me again.
We found this really old interview you did with David Byrne, which was really interesting, where you talked about how once you started painting that your writing got deeper, too.
Mm. Did I interview David or he interviewed me?
Well, I couldn't quite tell. You guys were kind of just both talking, which was pretty cool about that, I have to say.
Was that for Interview Magazine or no, it was for something else.
It was an interview.
A long time ago.
No, I'm sure it was, but I liked it because I couldn't tell who was interviewing whom, and which was really great. But but you were just talking about the fact that in some ways you said that accessing the same energy at a different place opened new doors, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not precious about that. I think it's the same thing with cooking. If you're making up a recipe, it's the same thing with scientists. Anything that you're truly engaged in and you want to go deeper, learn more, expand your palate, you know, I think it's the same process.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about the prose you write and how it's different from the songs you write, if it is different. You did this interview a few years ago with Melissa Block of NPR, and she said this in her introduction, that your writing had a kind of a cadence to it, and that your stories seemed created in the same way that you would create a good song. Is she right, or is it a similar process?
Yes, and I think particularly as a songwriter who works with melody all the time, that melody was like a lifeline when I was writing prose, and I kept looking for the melody, the cadence in the words. I mean, I think that a lot of writers do that, and great writers like Joyce do it particularly well. You know, you feel a rhythm and a melody that's just so persuasive and wonderful. And, you know, I'm a neophyte prose writer, but I was looking for it.
You talked about studying songwriting, like taking Bob Dylan lyrics and kind of breaking them down. Did you actually sort of put them in front of you and just see how they looked, you know what I mean, on the page together? Or was it a different?
Absolutely.
Really?
And not just Bob, but other writers. I would write them out, or I would read them if they were published, and think, why does this work? How did he get there? How did he make that leap? That line has nothing to do with the line before, but it works. Why does it work? You know, and deconstruct that. In the same way, I used to teach songwriting. Not that you can really teach songwriting, but, you know, I had a workshop. And in this, if people were writing folk songs, I felt they should know the tradition they came from. You're not new. Nobody is starting this, reinventing the wheel. And if you were writing in the style of Joni Mitchell, you better have listened to her.
Right.
And learning from the masters and know which tradition you're writing in. Yes, that's what we were talking about, writing down lyrics and seeing why they worked. And it was helpful. I met some young songwriters who thought that they didn't want to influence themselves by other writers, so they didn't listen to anything and thought that every expression that they had was original and true. And, you know, maybe it is, but how could you be a great writer without without reading great writing?
I guess this is the idea that your father was getting at when he gave you the list, right?
Great segue, Doug. I was floundering there. Yes. And he was tremendously attached to these songs, and they were like a blueprint of his soul. These songs, the Southern Delta and the blues and early folk songs and early country songs and Appalachian songs, this was a map for him that he found himself inside. And he made this list for me I knew a lot about pop and rock, and I grew up in Southern California, and I was president of my Beatles fan club, and I knew what was going on. And then I went on the road with him, and he realized that I didn't really know Long Black Veil or, you know, my early Hank Williams or the Sister Rosetta Tharpe or these great, great songs or the Carter Family. And he made this list for me, and it was an education.
Was Girl from the North Country on the list?
It was. You know, he loved Bob, and Bob loved him. In fact, I have a picture hanging in my living room of Bob. Jill Kermitz took this picture. My dad was playing Carnegie Hall. It was 1968. And Bob came to see him and then came backstage to say hello. And this picture is a triptych. In the first frame, you see Bob talking to my dad. Then the second frame, my dad has his hand over his vest pocket to say, I don't have a pen. And then in the third frame, he's signing an autograph for Bob.
Wow.
It's so adorable. But Girl from the North Country, you know, and Girl from the North Country borrowed from Scarborough Fair and borrowed from early Elizabethan folk songs. So it has a great provenance.
He wrote it in – Bob wrote it in 1963.
Right.
Your father recorded it 10 years later, I suppose it was.
69. With Bob on Nashville Skyline.
Yeah. And he wanted you to sing it as well. How did you come to it, I guess, because you put it on your album?
Well, it was on the list, and, you know, it's a great, great song. And it's so mournful. And I didn't want to try to even come close to aping my dad and Bob's version from 69. So we listened to the 63 version, which was, you know, more of a straight folk song.
Yeah.
Also, I really like that old folk trick of women singing about other women, because it expands the potential. You know, it could be your daughter, your sister, your friend, your partner. It could be anything.
Are you up for doing it?
Sure. Do you have that?
We do, yes.
Don't turn it up too loud. I'm not very good.
Okay.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fair, the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine. If you go when the snowflakes storm and rivers freeze and summer ends, please see she has a coat so warm to keep her from the howling winds. Oh, she remembers me at all. Many times I've often prayed in the darkness of my night, in the brightness of days. So if you're traveling in the North Country Fair, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. She once was a true love of mine.
That's Roseanne Cash with the Bob Dylan song, Girl from the North Country. Roseanne is going to be in Utah next Friday. That's August 31st at 8 o'clock. She's performing as a guest of the Davis Arts Council at the Kenley Amphitheater in Layton. For tickets, you can call 801-546-8575 or just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the artist, the singer-songwriter, Roseanne Cash. She's coming to Utah to give a concert next Friday. We'll give you details about that. She's joining us today from the studios of NPR in New York. Roseanne Cash, I wanted to ask you about, it wasn't so long ago that you yourself did, you filled in for Leonard Lopate on a program at WNYC. So, I mean, you've had to be on the other side doing an interview. What did you learn about that experience? What did you like?
That was scary. It was scary. I did like it. I was gained a new respect for how you guys hit your cues and get in and out and wind conversations down when you're at the top of an hour and all of that stuff. That all of that made me very nervous. But I got to speak to four friends of mine, musician Mike Doty, the theoretical physicist Lisa Randall, my friend Adri Trigiani, who's a successful writer, and Joe Ledoux, who's a neuroscientist who specializes in fear and danger, which was very exciting to talk about. So it was really fun. I had a great time, and I have new respect.
Do you think it worked? You know, does it work as a conversation? I mean,
I could only have a conversation with someone, and I'm a curious person, so yeah. That part was easy. But I don't know that I'd want your gig every day, Doug.
I want to ask you about. There's another song I want to ask you about. The World Unseen, and. You tell the story about it was the first song you wrote after your father's death, or God is in the Roses was the first one. This was the second one, and it's a reference to a psalm, Psalm 102, and you've talked about that you would read psalms to your father. I wanted to ask about that.
In the last year of his life. In the last year of his life, he loved the psalms, so I read the psalms aloud to him, and I wasn't very knowledgeable about the Psalms, and there was in Psalm 102 it says, "I am the sparrow on the roof."
Yeah,
and I was really struck by that image. And after my dad died, I started the song that way: "I'm the sparrow on the roof." I was working on the song for a while, and I didn't know how to finish it. And I went to Christmas Eve services at the Episcopal Church here, took my kids, and they sang that old Christmas carol, "Westward Leading, Still Proceeding." And I thought, that's perfect. And I just took that line and put it in my song. Because if you steal and it's that obvious, it's okay.
Right. Well, I mean, your husband, John, you say in the book that he encouraged you to kind of keep the lyrics of the song grounded, and he said somewhat kind of literal.
Yeah. I think when you're in a lot of pain, grief, or you're overwhelmed by emotion of any kind, I should speak about myself. I start wanting to write about themes, grand themes.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to hear about themes. People want to hear about the furniture and, whether you threw the coffee cup across the room and what was the weather when he left you. Those things move us deeply. And John, he was a great guiding principle when I was writing Black Cadillac, that whole record.
So then the focus was on houses and birds and bells.
We wrote a song called House on the Lake, which was about the house on the lake. The World Unseen was rooted in that psalm, but, it also has a lot of documentary detail in it.
Yeah. Would you sing it for us?
Sure. I'm the sparrow on the roof. I'm the list of everyone I have to lose. I'm the rainbow in the dirt. I am who I was and how much I can hurt. So
I will look for you in stories of the kings. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen. I'm the mirror in the hall. From your empty room, I can hear it fall. Now that we must live apart, I have a one half of my heart. So I will look for you between the grooves of songs we sing. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen. Westward leading, still proceeding to the world unseen.
It's Roseanne Cash. She is going to be in Utah next Friday. That's August 31st at 8 o'clock. She's performing as a guest of the Davis Arts Council at the Kenley Amphitheater in Layton. For tickets, call 801-546-8575, or you can just go online, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll give you a link there. We need to take another break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio.
My heart is sad and I'm in sorrow for the only one I love. When shall I see him? Oh, no, never till we...
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with Roseanne Cash. She's coming to Utah next Friday, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. Right now, she's joining us from the studios of NPR in New York City. I wanted to ask you about this homestead community where your father grew up. Is it Dyess or Dyess Colony?
Dyess. Dyess. Dyess Colony.
In Mississippi County, Arkansas. Your grandparents were one of, I guess it was 500 families who were recruited from the rolls of the welfare list to settle the area. This was 1935 or 36. Father was 3 years old. And you've been going back there. I wanted to ask the first time you went back, because this is where your father grew up. What was it like when you first saw the house?
I was about 12 when he first took me there. And wow, it was a revelation, you know, to see where my dad came from, because I always knew my dad as this famous musician, and we had a nice house, and, you know, we lived well. And to see where he came from, it was, even at 12, it was deeply moving. I had a lot of compassion for my dad that he had such a hard life. You know, he worked in the fields from the age of 8 years old and was backbreaking work, and they didn't have air conditioning, you know, all of these things that I was took for granted. But you're right, there were 500 families and who were desperately poor, and they had to apply. And this was the New Deal. It was a WPA program under Roosevelt. And they got in. They were one of the 500 chosen, and they got a new cottage and 40 acres and a mule. That's where that saying came from, 40 acres and a mule.
Yeah.
And it saved our lives. That program really saved my family's life.
You know, it's interesting if you think about it in the context kind of the political climate today. We get this question about what's the proper role of government. And, you know, this was conceived as an idea that the government is going to help people get back on their feet.
I have thought about this so much, Doug.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a program that now in the political climate today, they would say it's too intrusive, it's too much government, it's big government, we don't want it. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for that program, that WPA program. And not only that, I mean, they didn't save just these families, but they put artists to work. They put so many people to work. And it not only did it save them financially and physically, but it gave them hope and esteem that this country cares about you. You know, a WPA employed artist painted pictures for the murals for the subway, or all the things they did. You know, we care about you. We're going to put you to work. It was a good time in our country's history, really.
It's interesting. I mean, you know, they blasted stumps, they cut down trees, farmed cotton, corn, raised livestock. Mm-hmm. And I guess this is, you've talked about how this was really the place where your father's love of music began.
Oh, yes.
And I wondered about that. Was it the place itself, or was it the fact that, you know, there was music in the family, or did it have something to do with, you know, the physical space?
Well, my grandmother was a great kind of splashy gospel piano player, so there was that. And they didn't have a piano, but, you know, at some point. But, I mean, we could talk for ages about why that particular area of this country, the Delta, you know, gave rise to so many great musicians, from Robert Johnson on, and Sister Rosetta Tharpe, and the slave songs that turned into spirituals, slave spirituals that turned into gospel music, and just how rich that was. You know, Memphis alone, you have Sun and Stax from the same city. So my dad was surrounded by it. They did get a radio station. I mean, they had a radio that received a powerful signal from Mexico. You know, it was illegal in the States to put such a powerful signal, so they just put it over the line in Mexico, and that's where he heard all of these, the Grand Ole Opry and all of these radio stations.
So what do you think? Was it the heat? Was it that made you pensive in some way? Was it the backbreaking work that made you think about, you know, your lot in life? Any conclusions at all about that as you've been thinking about
it? I think you're on to something with the backbreaking work, because music was a balm. Yeah. You know, they would sing in the fields, and, you know, you start doing harmonies out in the fields, and it distracts you from the painful labor you're doing. And that certainly was one thing. But I think, you know, you go back to African music and slaves and the spirituals that came out of that was very important as well. But this house, exists. Only around 40 houses still exist from that WPA program in Dyess Colony. Mm. My dad's was one of them, and it was nearly falling down, but Arkansas State University purchased the house. So we're in the middle of a long-term restoration project.
You returned, it was last year or the year before, and you've written about how hard it was to see it in such a bad shape.
Yeah, it was painful. But, you know, the restoration team at the university are meticulous about restoring it accurately. And they're not only restoring my dad's house, but some of the administration buildings and other buildings in the little colony, the little circle there. And I've been back a few times now, and we did a huge concert last year to kick off the fundraising with George Jones and Chris Christopherson, and it was really great. And this year we're doing one in October in Jonesboro, Arkansas, with the Civil Wars, who are fantastic, and Willie Nelson and Dierks Bentley. So, you know, I'm committed to this for the long run.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it was this the actual experience itself, but you've been thinking a lot about that place. It's part of the album you're writing now, if I get it right?
Yeah, I have been thinking a lot. Going back there and the house and getting involved with this project and reconnecting with a lot of Southern people that I know and I knew as a child has just moved me to the core. And John, my husband, and I have started writing this album of Southern songs about the South, about Southern people and places, and we're about three quarters of the way finished writing it, and it is just so rich to me. You know, sometimes the South gets a bad rap again, and the political climate today is that they're rigid or intractable or, you know, super fringe right wing, but that's not necessarily true. There are some incredible people in the South with deep souls and great music and a lot going on down there.
I know there's a song, there's a working title, I guess. I'm not sure if it's the final word yet, but Etta's Tune.
Yeah, it's a song that John and I wrote recently. It was the first song we wrote for this project. And yeah, you're right. Etta's Tune is the working title. I'm not sure if it'll end up being that, but it refers to my dad's old bass player in the Tennessee Two. It was Marshall Grant, and his wife was Etta. Huh. And they were like second parents to me. They knew me from birth. Marshall Grant was the third person to hold me after I was born, and he died last year. And we wrote Etta's Tune.
You play it for us?
Sure. I'm learning it still myself, so give it a try.
Okay.
What's the temperature, darling? 100 or more. The horse is pawing at the dust, violets wilting by the door. But you pour the strongest coffee and I'll take the battered wheel. We'll drive straight down the river road and spread a blanket on the hill. What's the temperature, darling? Now don't stare into the past. There was nothing we could change or fix. It was never gonna last. Now don't stare into those photos. Don't analyze my eyes. We're just a mile or two from Memphis and the rhythm of our lives. A mile or two from Memphis and I must go away. I tore up all the highways. There's nothing left to say. A mile or two from Memphis and I finally made it home. There were days you paced the kitchen. There were nights I spent in jail. When the phone rang in the dead of night, you would always throw my bill. No, you never touched the whiskey, and you never took the pills. I traveled for a million miles while you were standing still. What's the temperature, darling, as the daylight fades away? I'll make one last rehearsal with one foot in the grave. We kept the house on old Nokomis. We kept the polished bass guitar. We kept the tickets and the reels of tape to remember who we are. A mile or two from Memphis, and I must go away. I tore up all the highways. There's nothing left to say. A mile or two from Memphis, and I finally made it home. What's the temperature, darling?
Roseanne Cash. So, is it coming together, the album? Are you feeling good about it so far?
Yeah, I feel so excited. I feel like it's my first record.
Wow.
One song we wrote is called The Sunken Lands. And the area where the Dyess Colony is they call it the Sunken Lands because the Missouri quake in the 19th century sunk that whole area of the Mississippi Valley. And so it's been called the Sunken Lands since then. So we wrote this song, The Sunken Lands, and I wrote a song about my friend in Florence, Alabama. It's really exciting, really fun.
I wanted to ask you about this, something you had talked about before, the experience of being on stage and how for your father, but not just for your father, for times when things weren't going so well with, say, your husbands or boyfriends or friends or whatever, how in some way it gets fixed on stage.
I have experienced that.
Yeah.
I have experienced many times my husband and I in a fight and we have to walk on stage and then I look at him playing some solo or... And it just melts me. It just melts me. And we come off and we hug and it's all over. And we never talk about it. That's happened a lot. With my dad, the story you're referring to, he was playing Carnegie Hall again. And I was mad at him about – I mean, I was in my 40s, for God's sake. I was mad at him about some childhood slight or something. And he asked me to sing I Still Miss Someone with him in the show that night. And I said, no, you know, very, you know, with my nose, no, I don't think so. And he asked me three times. And the third time he asked me, he turned and walked away. And I saw his back. And I had seen his back from the wings on stage so many times. And it suddenly moved me so much, you know, just that vision of my dad's with the spotlights on him, seeing him from the back. And I called after him. I said, Dad, I'll sing it with you. And I walked on stage and I was just at the verge of tears seeing him in the place that he loved the most, which was under the spotlight. And it just disappeared. It just disappeared. You see a person's beauty. You see their best self. You see them giving it to a crowd and the crowd giving it back to them. How could you not love that person?
Let me ask you this finally. There's another dream that you write about in the book. It's like 3 years or something like that after your dad had died. And you have this dream where you're visiting this museum.
Yeah.
And you talk about how it provided a kind of comfort to you or anyway a sense of relief. Do you mind talking about that?
Yeah, I've never talked about that dream publicly except writing in my book. No one's ever asked me about it, Doug. So I visited him and it was a beautiful place that was like a museum, but there was a forest and there was light and there were people taking care of him. And I woke up from the dream feeling that he was being taken care of, that I didn't have to worry anymore.
Yeah. Roseanne Cash, her recent album, recent albums are The List, The Essential Roseanne Cash. She's also written a memoir. The book is called Composed. Next Friday, August 31st at 8 o'clock, she's going to be performing as a guest of the Davis Arts Council. It's at the Kenley Amphitheater in Layton, Utah. For tickets, call 801-546-8575 or visit us at radiowest.kuer.org for links. Roseanne Cash joined us today from the studios of NPR in New York. And Roseanne, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you, Doug. This has been a thoroughly enjoyable hour.
Thanks. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to KUER's Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Sister will do, but she'll get married too.